Good evening and welcome to this WTTW News Special, launching the year-long multi-platform initiative, Firsthand Democracy. I'm Brandis Friedman. As the country prepares to mark the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, we'll be documenting how individuals and local organizations are responding to challenges and opportunities around democracy. You can find the Firsthand Democracy documentaries and much more at WTTW.com/firsthand. For the next 60 minutes, we'll kick off this series with a conversation about civic attitudes and civic life in Chicago and beyond with our panel and a live studio audience. This program, as always, is streaming on our website as well as Facebook and YouTube. The first half hour is being broadcast on WTTW, and then we'll continue exclusively online, again, on our website, WTTW.com, Facebook, and YouTube. So let's meet our panelists as we get into this discussion. We're going to start with Jennifer Benz. She's Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Media Research at the National Opinion Research Center, known as NORC, at the University of Chicago. Jenny, welcome. Thank you for joining us. So you conducted a survey looking at civic cynicism in the U.S., and you found that lots of Americans are relatively pessimistic about the country's future. Only about a quarter said that the best days of our country are still ahead. Only about a quarter think the United States is the greatest country in the world, and barely 1 in 10 Americans think that the government represents them well. And that pessimism you all found, it's across party lines. What does all of this tell you?
Yeah, we set out to do a study in the summer ahead of the 2024 presidential election. And we were really trying to just understand the public's mood, like their underlying sense of the country's direction, where we were headed, their feelings toward one another, and trying to take a step back and move a little bit away from some of the research that gets done in presidential election years that's really just kind of following the news of the day. And in doing that, we surveyed about 3,000 Americans, and we weren't expecting a rosy picture to come out of it, but the really deep and widespread sense of pessimism was pretty profound in this study, and it just came out in a range of different ways, from people's sense of, right, this kind of decline in what has historically been an American kind of eternal optimism, that statistic you cited that only a quarter of Americans feel like the country's best days are ahead, and even some concerns about kind of fundamental principles in the country, this idea that there were 7 in 10 Americans had at least some level of concern that there wasn't going to be a peaceful transition of power in the presidential election. And so just this really widespread concern about the future and a really, really deep concern about our country's institutions and a genuine lack of trust and confidence in our leaders.
What do we know about whether those feelings, those results or measures have changed over time?
We've been tracking a lot of these different measures over time. And when it comes to trust in our institutions, NORC has been conducting something called the General Social Survey since the 1970s. And trust in our institutions, it tends to fluctuate over time, largely in response to different issues, Watergate, 9/11, things like that. But over the last 20 years, we've really just seen this like steady decline in almost every institution, especially government institutions. There have been some institutions, the military, scientific community, that still have relatively high levels of trust, but we're even starting to see cracks in those, like a deep polarization growing in trust of the scientific community, for example. But a lot of these measures of cynicism have declined dramatically over the last 20 years, and especially over the last 10 years.
Yeah. And we know one of those institutions is media. We're going to talk about that later on as well. But next I want to bring in Alexandra Falendra. She's a professor of both political science and of psychology at the University of Illinois Chicago. Her work includes studies related to democracy and democratic attitudes in the public and, again, trust in public institutions. Alexandra, thanks for joining us also. From a political psychology perspective, what are some of the factors that cause people to lose trust in institutions?
So a key factor is a partisanship. We see sort of a periodic cyclical change in trust in institution based on who's in government. So if your party is in government, you start to feel more confident in your institutions. When your party is out of government, you're more skeptical. But we see, as Jennifer said, two different kinds of mistrust and skepticism. One is this sort of healthy skepticism of government that, hey, they're important, institutions are great, we should have them. Sometimes bad things happen. And then there is the destructive cynicism about institutions that we should just burn everything to the ground and start all over, or we shouldn't have anything. Nothing works for me, therefore let me light a match. And that is very, very counterproductive and problematic given where we are. And we're seeing increases in this very cynical, rather than pure skepticism, which is actually American to its core. It's part of our foundation, our heritage, to be skeptical of institutions. It goes back to the revolution, but that's the healthy skepticism. The negative skepticism, the mistrust that is rooted in grievances, is very counterproductive and can be very hurtful for democracy.
How much of this current moment would you say is sort of like the natural ebb and flow of distrust, sort of like what we heard earlier? Versus, you know, what we've seen, you know, and then we've seen that, you know, over centuries, over generations, right? Versus, you know, this is unique and a long-lasting amount of distrust.
It is fairly unique because we are seeing trust crashing in ways we haven't seen it before. And we see mistrust in other people and in other groups in that has turned not just that in from general dislike to dehumanization, to hate, to I see the other side as my enemies and I rejoice when they are hurt. And that is very dangerous in a society when you see other members of your community as fundamental enemies that should be destroyed.
Okay, I want to bring in, you know, because we've laid out, I want to bring in our next guest, because we've laid out sort of like the landscape and where it is right now. I'd like to have a bit of hope and optimism. Verne Green, you are the CEO of MCVA Challenge. That is, of course, an organization that's been around for almost 30 years and helps the youth to be empowered, informed, and active citizens. One of MCVA's, you know, very strong values is, of course, written on your shirt, democracy is a verb. Tell us what that means and about the attitudes of the young people that you work with.
I was so hoping you were coming to me when you said hope, because I do believe that young people are a big part of the hope that we seek. Democracy is a verb. It means that democracy is action. Young people should be active, not passive. Participants in what's happening in our society. We have a curriculum that runs through schools nationwide and really encouraging teachers to set up their classrooms and spaces in a way that young people are able to dialogue even across differences. People who have different philosophies, different beliefs, get a chance to connect with one another and think about what's that next step that needs to be taken. So we're seeing a lot that's happening nationwide, and really our job at MCVA Challenge is to encourage young people to be a part of the solution. One of the questions that we ask them is, what's the most pressing issue and what do you think should be done about it? So really empowering them to think about the role that they can play in being part of the solution to some of our society's greatest ills.
And how do you think that early participation in civic engagement in the process, how does it set them up for long-term involvement through the rest of their lives?
I'll just give a personal example. I mean, I was a student who my teachers gave me a chance to speak up and speak out, and I never stopped. And so if you
and here we are, everybody.
Clearly, if you encourage young people early, give them a chance to be heard. And even if it's just as small as what needs to change in your classroom, maybe it's the setup. I had a student who told me when I was a teacher, I don't necessarily like the format. This doesn't help when I come in. That student is a community organizer, you know, at this point. It's like just really small connections, things that start really early, give you the confidence, the skills, the ability to be able to make longer decisions because you've had that practice and you've seen changes happen as a result. Another really quick example, in Chicago Public Schools, they were asking students about not having police officers in schools, and that turned into a task force that some of our students were able to be a part of, and they were able to say, we don't need police, we actually need mental health workers. They spoke up for what was important to them, and changes happen. When that change happens, that tells a young person, my voice matters, my perspective matters, and I will continue to do that throughout life.
Thank you. And last but not least, we've got Marianne Coulter. Now, you are the Illinois coordinator for Braver Angels. Mm-hmm. That is an organization that helps people with different political views better understand one another. You're also featured in one of the firsthand documentaries that our audience can see online. We're going to play a bit of that right now.
The Braver Angels mission is to end depolarization in America, getting together and talking to one another, to stop treating each other as if we're enemies. When we talk about the other side, what we tend to do are we end up stereotyping. We dismiss them. We ridicule them. And we talk with contempt. We found it helpful to distinguish between, get one up, positions and people. Don't lump a person because they happen to be on one side to, it's like, oh, you're a red, you must think this about this issue. You know, that's not necessarily true. So separate that person from the position. You can have huge disagreements with a position, doesn't mean that person on that side, or even if they hold that position, is really an awful person.
So Marianne, Braver Angels, you all do a lot to convene conversations between what we might call the blues and the reds, mm-hmm. To help bring people together during these polarized times. Tell us about how people come to these seminars and events that we just saw a little bit of just now, and how you work with them to guide them to hear one another. How do you teach that?
Yeah, well, you kind of nailed it. People walk in the door like very skeptical. You know, they're looking around saying, I can't talk to these people. This is all going to be very confrontational. And we take them through. One of the workshops is about looking at yourself and how you're contributing to polarization. And another workshop, just those languages, those listening skills, how important it is to listen and acknowledge what other people say, and not just jump right in with your perspective and start talking at them. The your facts are better than my facts conversations that don't work. But the magic really happens when we do things called, we have a red-blue workshop, where we get equal parties of each side, and just listening, what is it like to be a red in this country? What is it like to be a blue? And people walk away, and there's parts in the film where they say, like, we want to talk some more, you know, and they walk in thinking that they didn't want to talk to each other at all. And then we also have workshops where we take a single issue, like immigration's our big issue now, but I've done them on abortion, role of policing, where people walk in and they say, there's no way we're going to agree on anything. And they walk out with, you know, 5 or 10 points that they're now going to take to their elected officials and say, here, this is what we want you to do. You know, can we try this? And they're modeling what we want our elected officials to be doing.
So it sounds then like, you know, because we hear a lot about people who are entrenched on their side, like you said, my facts are better than your facts, you're wrong,
yep.
And we can't even have a conversation about it. I can't even work with you. You're not operating with the same set of facts.
Yeah.
Does your experience, does it give you hope then that, you know, the barriers that so many people have erected, that those can be broken down and we can get to a more civil and understanding society?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, every day I walk into a workshop, or every time I walk into a workshop, it walks in with a little cynicism, so with that doubt, and you walk out with hope, and you see people walking out with hope. And the video starts with in the church that we saw, where we always ask to start with, why are you here? What brought you here today? What are your concerns? And some of the stories are heartbreaking. Families breaking up. I'm going to lose my best friend. I'm afraid to talk to people anymore. And when you see them walk out of the workshop now going like, yeah, I could do this. I can do this. Can I do more? Can I do more? And, you know, and first thing I like to tell people is that, remember, it takes practice. It always takes, you know, more practice. You're not going to get this, you know, like that. I've been doing this for 6 years, and I'm still working on it. But it does give me hope. And we're working with younger and younger kids all the time, which really, high school civics teachers are my new superheroes. And we were out at a junior high in Rockford. Shout out to Mrs. Barnett. And the seventh graders were like, yeah, we need to listen to each other's perspectives, and we really need to acknowledge what they say. And it's okay when we don't agree, and that should be fine. And I'm like, yeah, these kids have nothing to unlearn, you know, if we teach them right the first time. So we've gotten so entrenched into our silos that we can't talk to one another, and we need to get out of those silos and sit across the table face to face.
So high school civics teachers are your new superheroes. We have one, yes. Because another person who was featured in our Firsthand Democracy series is a civics teacher at Evanston High School. Let's take a look at a little bit of that.
We got 15 yeses, we have 3 noes, and we have 9 maybes. All right, this is a great starting point. When you're in these like small group discussions, listen with intention.
He believes that vaccines will give you autism.
There has been just like a fundamental breakdown from adults to have respectful civil dialogue with one another about important government level topics.
And number one, to get up and argue with Congress like that in front of millions of other people, that is so dangerous because they're refusing to address the information that's been backed up.
They can turn on the news at any given time, and just like the tone and just the hate that adults sometimes present from their side upon the other side. Us adults are maybe not the best role models for this younger generation to sort of have some of those discussions.
And our Nick Blumberg is out in this audience with that civics teacher, Meetin Patel. Nick.
That's right, Brandis. We're here with the man himself. So, you know, clearly you have a very engaged group of students that you're working with. We've been talking a lot about, you know, the cynicism that people feel. Do you feel that from your students? Do you experience that?
I would say absolutely not. Like, I have the best job in the world. I'm the luckiest teacher in the world. Like, my students come to class and have always come to class ready to do just that. Like, speak their sort of hearts, speak their minds. But I think the most important thing is to listen to what someone else is going to say and take in what they say, not instantly reject it, but like absorb it, hear it, and acknowledge it, and then, you know, respond when they feel that they need to.
Yeah, is that something that you think, you know, the students are necessarily have a predisposition toward, or is that something that, is that kind of a skill that you try to help teach them, that listening, that active listening?
Yeah, I think that active listening, you know, we want to model that in positive ways, like in the classroom. But I'm always shocked and pleasantly surprised just how quickly they pick up on that. They click into gear and they're ready to engage and they're ready to discuss on things that they care about. And this is what we do every day.
Yeah, and I think oftentimes folks may have, you know, negative stereotypes of young people that, you know, they can't pick up on these concepts or that they're not interested in that. But it would seem like the work that you do kind of puts the lie to that idea.
Yeah, I would say that's hogwash. I mean, these young adults, like, they're ready to go. They care about the same things that us adults care about, and they want to see changes in a lot of the same places that we want to see changes. And they're just as, you know, excited to sort of, again, speak their minds, but also do their part so they can actually have those changes play out.
All right, Meetin Patel, thanks for the work that you do.
Nick, thank you. Marianne, what is your reaction when you hear something like that from
Yay.
Mr. Patel?
Yay.
Awesome.
Yeah, no, again, the kids, they just soak it up like a sponge. And they get it. My favorite email I got was from a high school teacher. It's actually my alma mater. Wrote us back about 6 weeks after we did a workshop with her students. And she said, the parents are sending me, I had parent-teacher conferences, and they're saying, what did you do to my child? They want to talk to me again. They want to talk to where my views came from. What are my perspectives? How did I come to that view? And that's one of the things we say, like, what's your personal perspective that you bring to that? And also be willing to It's okay to say you disagree, even with your parents, but have that conversation.
Renee.
I mean, he's doing what schools are designed to do. Schools are civic spaces, and they are designed to train young people with the skills to go out and be civic participants and civic leaders. So the ability to have that dialogue in class is exactly where what schools are supposed to be doing. So I was like, yay.
Also yay. So also in the audience, we've got reporter Joanna Hernandez with Priscilla Mims of the Cook County League of Women Voters. Joanna.
Thank you, Brandis, and thank you, Priscilla, for joining us. Now, my question here is, your grandmother didn't have a chance to vote. How did that shape the work that you do now?
Well, it really made me realize how much both I have a right and a privilege to be able to vote. And so it makes it personal for me, and I want to make sure that I exercise that right, that privilege, and that responsibility.
And Priscilla, we're seeing a mobilization of just many more voters heading out to protest, to rallies. How do you capture that momentum?
Well, that's a great question. Hopefully, we are very active in a lot of the demonstrations, registering people to vote right there and then. And I think those people who attend realize how important it is that voting can impact their daily lives. And that's the message we try to get across.
Can you share a little bit about what that experience is like when you're there at these protests and rallies? What is that feeling like, that energy, the people that you do get to register to vote?
Well, it's very exciting. Obviously, when you have that many people all together, exercising their right of free speech and trying to make their views known to not only those around them, but also, thanks to the press, a much wider audience. And they realize that being actively engaged makes all the difference.
So you get to see that people change their minds.
I think they do. I think they get energized, and that makes them more committed to making sure that they not only vote, but many of them then decide to run for office or get actively involved in the political process.
Is there a question that you would like to ask one of the panelists?
Yes, I'd love to know any of your ideas further on how to get people engaged. We have ideas, but we're always looking for new ones.
Excellent question.
Okay,
Marianne, I'm going to throw that to you.
I'm going to take, because I said sometimes people walk into our workshops and they're very hesitant, and sometimes it's, why are you here? Because my pastor begged me, right? And once they find out, our events are very structured, and providing that safe space to talk across the aisle, and you know, no shouting, no name calling, you know, having those ground rules in place that we're treating everybody with dignity and respect, and that seems to be our secret sauce of how well our workshops go.
All right, thank you for that question and for the answer. I want to talk a little bit more, if we can, about media, because it is something that we just heard Ms. Mims mention. Jennifer, what have you learned about trust in media?
Yeah, so media is definitely one of the institutions that has seen a deep decline in trust over the years. It's about equal with Congress, and it's hard, doesn't go much lower than that, I'm afraid, in terms of institutions in the country. But what we've really seen with our new and more complicated information ecosystem is that's how people respond when we ask them about trust in the media or in journalism generally. On a day-to-day basis, though, most people in this country have news sources that they trust. And when you ask them about their media, you know, they generally feel that their media is fair and balanced, that it does a good job of keeping them informed about current events, and that, you know, it's skewed a little bit toward helping as opposed to hurting our democracy. So we do find that people are able to find media sources that they can believe in. One of the challenges, though, is the pathway to finding those media sources. And for large segments of the country, we find that people have really become passive news consumers. Like they're more likely to bump into news as they're going about other activities, mostly online, than they are to actively seek out a particular news source. And so the concern is always, what are they bumping into when they're online?
We've got just about a minute left here, but obviously we're going to keep this conversation going. Marianne, I know you talk a lot about media and news sources and the blues and the reds, and something that Jenny just mentioned is people trusting their sources, yeah, but not other sources. Have you been able to see change in people's attitudes when they look at the information that the, quote, other side is getting?
Yeah. Well, one of the things you'll see in the video is we do an exercise called Walk a Mile in My News. And we'll get a red and a blue paired up and trade news sources and read what are you reading, what are you reading, and compare, you know, what are the commonalities. And one of the things we discovered is get out of the headlines and get into the details and put on your critical thinking skills, and really, you know, dive into the issue. And then the other thing that came up is just trust, because people gravitate towards trust. And if you get into those, my facts are better than your facts,
you can always say, but with news.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah. So who do you trust?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We're going to come back to that in just a minute, because as we mentioned at the top, we are continuing this conversation online. So if you're already streaming online, great. Stay right there. If you're watching on television, you can keep watching this program by switching over to streaming on WTTW.com, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're not watching live Monday at 5:30, the entire 60-minute program can be found online as well. Again, we're not done, so join us for the next half hour online at WTTW.com, Facebook, and YouTube for more with our panel and our audience. It all continues in just a moment, so we will see you there.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
For joining us online, we now continue our conversation, kicking off WTTW's Firsthand Democracy Project. Again, you can access the firsthand documentaries, in-depth reporting, and much more at WTTW.com/firsthand. So we were talking about the media and trust in the media. Alexandra, I want to get you in here because I want to know what your research, your overall scholarship says about sources of news and information and how that informs trust and, you know, interactions with institutions.
So people tend to segregate into their own political spaces, even within the media, and receive their sources, as Jennifer said, from those media that are considered partisan media from their side. What we've seen from experimental work is that if you switch people's media diet, their attitudes change, their views change. So if you take them out of watching the same program day in and day out and put them in to watch something that is different, like PBS, their attitudes start to move away from the partisan extreme towards the center. So we have firsthand experimental information about the role that media plays in shaping people's opinions and in actually sort of validating their prior beliefs about what the world looks like and what they should be believing. So that is a very important part of how media both can generate trust within the partisan sphere and also create mistrust by amplifying these beliefs that the other side is not to be trusted.
Vernay, you work with a lot of young people. They are often on social media. How do you work with them to learn use sources that are trustworthy and to vet those sources before believing anything that they may have seen, especially in an age of, dare I say it, AI?
Sure, sure. One of the skills that we really press upon for young people is to be curious and to look for multiple sources. So it's really easy to grab the information that falls into your social media feed, for example, but that kind of puts you in an echo chamber of just experiences that are like your own. So really challenging young people to think, if you keep hearing the same message over and over again, maybe switch your source and ask different questions and look for both sides of the issue. We're not necessarily a debate organization, but we do encourage young people to look at multiple perspectives and multiple sides of the same issue. We also can't do it all as an organization, and so we encourage teachers and young people to look at organizations like News Literacy Project or other groups that have curricula that are focused on really trying to understand and pick apart information. Information is, it's wild. Stories are wild right now. And sometimes if they are super wild, that's a trigger for someone to say, hey, maybe this isn't true. Maybe I need to dig deeper. But really the answer for us is be curious and inquire more.
Coming back to the loss of trust in institutions overall, Alexandra, your work as a political psychologist, you've examined, you know, how and why people lose trust in institutions. What is going on at the individual level when someone loses trust in an institution, not just the media?
So a variety of things can happen. One is you can develop apathy because institutions don't work for you. And therefore, what's the point? And you may be just basically not pay any attention to what's happening around you, not vote, become a very distant and apathetic citizen. And that is problematic. Or another thing you could do is that you may become one of those people who are like, nothing works for me, and therefore I want it to burn down. You can become an extremist activist, there is a need for chaos person. That's what we call it in political psychology. They've developed a term for it. So that you want to create chaos, you're so angry that you literally want to burn it down. Those people who have developed that kind of attitude are very, very dangerous for a democracy because they can be goaded to act upon these attitudes. Social media can make it easier for you to overcome psychological limits to engagement with violence or with really other behaviors that are unacceptable. And because you think that it's worth burning everything to the ground, it's easier to behave in those ways that are consistent with this. So we need to build up the trust in order to insulate and inoculate ourselves as a community from these very dangerous tendencies.
We're going to get to audience questions in just a second, but because you mentioned, you know, sort of like the chaos thrower, I wanted to come back to Jenny because your survey identified five groups of Americans outside of the traditional categories, right, like race, age, gender, by which we can sort of understand civic cynicism and where those folks fall. What can you tell us about those categories?
Yeah, exactly. So we were trying to take the population and sort of move beyond the kind of classic cuts and understand this level of public mood and cynicism. And we found that there were about five groups that emerged. And only two of those groups kind of fall in the traditional left-right political partisan camps. We found about 22% of the population was in like a classically liberal sort of group, very democratic leaning, and you know, you can very clearly place them on the left. There was another group about the same size, we called them mostly MAGA, Trump supporters, very conservative on a lot of social issues, and you can very clearly place them on the right in today's kind of dialogue around political partisanship. But that left like 60% of the country that isn't really seen or talked about in that left-right dialogue that we have in so many situations. And of those, we found a fairly large group. About half of them we called them the ambivalent, and they're just very middle of the road on issues, on their feelings about their country. They're not necessarily optimistic or pessimistic. They tend to bump into the news especially. And then we had a small group, 13%, that we called the believers. They're the standard bearers of just about everything in this country, still have a deep belief in the American dream, really foundational support for things like diversity in the country, a lot of hope about the future. And then there was another group that was about 15%. And these were who we called the disillusioned. And they're the ones that a majority of them, we asked a question, do you think, what is it gonna take to get the country back on track, basically? And a majority of them said a complete and total upheaval. Whereas for the country as a whole, about 60% said we need substantial change in the way the country's run, but only 25% said a complete and total upheaval. So this is the chaos group, the Bernadette.
That's still a quarter.
Yeah, it's still a lot, right.
All right,
yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. Nick Blumberg, you have an audience question for us.
That's right, Brandis. I am here with Andrew Eastmond, who is not only a member of our audience, he's also a village trustee in River Woods. Thank you for being here. What would you like to ask?
Sure, I want to ask my friend Marianne a question. Since we don't have enough positivity in our political and civic life, as we've documented here tonight, is there a favorite brief story that you have from your work with Braver Angels that gives you a lot of hope and inspiration for the future? Is there something that, you know, really stood out at in terms of your work, in terms of, you know, just that gave you a lot of hope?
Yeah, I have two short stories. And one involves Andy's also with Principals First. And so I went to the Principals First dinner one night, and I was sitting with a sea of conservatives, and I've never felt so welcomed and at home and met such a lovely group of people in my life. And the second one was when we got a group of Blue Braver Angels together with a group of young Republicans, and we found so much in common. And I think that's the hope part, is getting people together in the same room. And every time we can do that, I see changes.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for that question. Gonna go back to Joanna Hernandez, also in the audience, with a question from an audience member.
Hey, Brandis. Yes, we have a local here from Albany. His name is Ed Doc. What is your question?
It's a question that's sort of for the group. We've been talking a lot about the grassroots of being able to get civic engagement and get people to kind of look each other in the eye and say, oh, yeah, we both care about our kids and our schools, things like that. And then you go and turn on Fox News, CNN, OAN, any number of networks, and it's like, oh, no, everybody wants to kill each other. Everybody hates each other. So I realize that that's advertising revenue and clicks, but how do you suppress that?
How do you suppress that? I can see each of you kind of thinking. Jenny, do you feel like you can tackle that first?
I don't know if I have a solution, but I know we definitely see in the data exactly what you're saying. I've been talking a lot about some of the national studies we've done. NORC also runs a survey called Chicago Speaks of residents in the city of Chicago. And we do see, I mean, there is still pessimism about a lot of things on the local level too, but it is greatly reduced. And that's a pretty longstanding trend in all of the political science literature. One interesting thing, as you were talking about, with one thing that is just universal in the data, cuts across every demographic, every political party group, is this just massive disappointment in our elected officials these days, and a really pervasive sense of some of the root causes of that. People really are concerned about the role of money in politics. They really don't feel seen or understood by their elected officials. They're deeply concerned that the incentive structure for politicians these days is to be self-serving or to serve the party and not the people. And so, you know, potentially one solution to all of this is kind of leveraging this, you know, one area for agreement and one, you know, common concern that is cross-cutting across everybody.
Alexandra, is there anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, what we know in political science and political psychology is that leaders are enormously important for humans, for human groups, because they define what the group's identity and values are supposed to be like. So we behave and we follow our leaders because we want to feel good standing members of the group. And the best way to do that is by mirroring our leaders. So there's huge responsibility in our leaders, whether at the local level, the state level, or the national level, to model behavior that we want our communities to follow, our people to follow. And then at the individual level and at the grassroots level, we need to have a conversation too about whether our leaders match our vision of who a true American is like and should be like and what our values are. And is it worth it to have people who don't match those values just because they have the right party standard with them? So we have to have this conversation, and whether it is more important to maintain our values or our partisanship.
Alexandra, you've also you've identified redistricting as a way to sort of bring the temperature down and decrease some polarization. Tell us how redistricting could help.
So right now, the way that a lot of states do redistricting is the legislature basically tinkers with lines of districts in ways that advantage the party in control. And with contemporary algorithms, you can do it in ways that are super, super refined. Basically, gerrymandering, which is what we're talking about, has existed literally since the beginning of the country's history. It's not new. But the difference is, in 1790, they did it with simple math and on paper and with approximations. Today, you have computers that tell you exactly who's going to vote, where they're going to vote, and what to expect. So they can basically predict districting very, very well. The result has been that both at the national level, our national legislature and our state legislatures have become safe to the party that controls them. And right now, at the federal level, I think there are 36 competitive districts, maybe fewer than that, where it's really a toss-up. Everything else is safe. There are numerous districts where there is no opponent because it doesn't pay for the other party to try to win and spend the money and the resources when the partisan difference is 40 or 50%. How are you going to win there? If we have what some states have is redistricting commissions. California had that. Recent events changed that. But basically, it's an independent redistricting commission that is made up of scientists and bipartisan people. And the districting is done based on the congruence of the districts, not like little snakes that go around, but actually organized where populations are. And this way, you can have competitive districts, which where people actually are 50-50. And that represents all of us better, because that means we're bringing politics to the middle. There is a better chance to have a general election that is competitive.
Right now, the politicians themselves, I imagine, would also have to come to the middle instead of playing what we often hear is sort of to the base.
Absolutely, because today the only election that matters is the primary, which is in a few weeks. So everybody go vote.
Yeah, everybody go vote. Nick Blumberg in the audience again with another audience member.
Brandis, I am here with Curtis, who has a question for the panel.
How y'all doing? So my question is around engaging folks who are incarcerated at the moment and those who are formerly incarcerated, because what I understand is that from my own, you know, I'm formerly incarcerated myself, a lot of folks don't know that they can vote when they get out, right? So we just started having situations where folks were being taught civics in prison just about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, right? And so there's a lot of folks who are re-entering that want to be engaged. So what kind of work are you guys doing, one, to engage folks who are formerly incarcerated, and what kind of work are you doing to make sure that folks inside know that they have these avenues to vote, to register, and things like that?
Renee or Marianne, either of you? Because I do want to point out that we also have some really great reporting about that very issue on our website, again, wttw.com/firsthand, and I think that might provide a little bit more of like the color and the information that he's looking for, and I think it also comes up in one of the documentaries as well, where it's an issue that hits home for some of our characters there.
I would say if there's any people who are incarcerated and would like me to come and do a workshop with them and tell them about what it's like and how to get along with others when we get out, I'm there.
Vernay, I want to come back to you because you say about 90% of Mikvah alumni who are eligible to vote, they actually do vote in elections. They stay involved in their communities. Some may run for school boards. Others may be for elected office. Obviously, not all of them are going to do this. But how does Mikvah get young people involved at such a young age and engaged in our public institutions?
Sure. I mean, some of it is just that simple, education of voting is sort of the end goal, that we want people to be engaged, voters, but also just be involved in decision-making, classroom-based decision-making, citywide decision-making. Here in Chicago, we actually have a council that sort of addresses the question that was brought up around issues of safety and justice. So we bring young people to decision-makers who are deciding juvenile justice policy, and young people get to be inform the decisions that are being made, the policy decisions that are being made. We also have a council that works with Chicago Public Schools, and as decisions and policies are being made there, students who are directly impacted by those decisions go straight to the decision maker, the elected official, the appointed official, the school board official. And so really trying to help them to see that, again, the voting is the end, but it is if you are able to influence a policy while you are in school. It could be a classroom base. It could be talking to your principal about a change that's made. That leads to that longer term civic engagement because students get a chance to see and understand that direct connection between decisions that are made today and the role that they've been able to play as a student even before they've been able to vote. We also for years have partnered with the Board of Elections, for example, and students have been able to serve as election judges even before they're eligible to vote. So for us, a big part of our tagline is democracy is a verb, is that we help young people to learn democracy by doing it and being involved and being able to see things happen before they're able to even formally directly participate as an elected voter, as a real voter.
So polling often finds that young people, millennials, Gen Z, well, younger millennials, because we're getting on, are the most disillusioned about politics and democracy. What do you attribute that to?
I mean, it's if it doesn't feel real, if it doesn't feel relevant to a student, then you can be disillusioned by it. I mean, somebody brought up the example. You're turning on the news and you're seeing something that seems really far away, or you're seeing adults behave badly, or you're seeing a disconnect between what you've learned about the Constitution and what actually is truly unfolding in government. That makes it really, really hard to trust the institution, to trust the system, because what we're seeing now, what we've really learned is that, and really see, is that when we bring issues very local to students, that's why I keep going back to school, what's the institution that impacts young people directly in this moment, when they have the chance to engage there, it builds confidence. Also, we try our best to introduce them to elected officials and other civic leaders so they get a chance to see these folk may look like me. They may live in my neighborhood. Or when I go to their office, because I am a constituent, I can ask questions and get those questions answered. So our goal is to bring them as close as we can to government and do that really locally at first, because that's more of what they can touch and see. And I will say in this day and age, it feels more actionable than thinking about things at the federal level.
All right, thank you for that answer. Joanna Hernandez in the audience with another audience member and a question.
Yeah, Brandis, I have a student at the University of Chicago. Can you tell me your name and what you're studying?
My name's Milena, and I'm studying public policy, sociology, and human rights.
That's awesome. It's aligning to what we're talking about. Tell me a little bit about what your question is about.
Yeah, so given kind of the cultivation of distrust in our democratic institutions that has been happening with many government officials and elected officials, I was just kind of curious, like, what your guys' thoughts were on how this trust can be restored and, like, how we can make these institutions, like, set back up in a way that they can continue to function with trust.
Jenny, can I come to you first on that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think one thing that we see out of this study that we did, where we sort of identified these five different groups, is that on the one hand, maybe we need to segment our approach a little bit, and we need to take advantage of some groups like the believers group that we talked about and use them as role models for how to be engaged civically, for how to talk to one another, for how to tolerate different beliefs. But on the other hand, there are these kinds of cross-cutting themes that we can leverage too. And one thing that we did really see is that when you break it down to the fundamentals, in a lot of ways, the country still has deep, deep agreement. You know, we are broadly in agreement on the importance of a democratically elected government as part of our country's identity, but a majority of people in the country think that the democracy is operating poorly. So it's really about this disconnect between our fundamental principles and how they're actually being executed by our government and office today. And so I think, you know, to the extent that we can really help people see that we do have some fundamental agreements, we just disagree on the execution, that can be a stepping stone to more conversation.
Looks like everybody's got something. Marianne and then Brene, go on.
I just want to point out, we did a deportation forum for Brave Angels. It's an hour and a half long. You can find it on YouTube. And it was just those kinds of conversations. We had two ordinary citizens. We had two members of Congress and four people in policy, you know, all talking about what about the whole system of deportation? It goes well. What are you concerned about? You know, what are your values around it? When we boil things down to values and concerns, we find a lot of agreement. And at the end, there was, you know, we asked everybody, you know, what's your key takeaway? And everybody's like, this is great, this is great. And the last person even said, oh, but I'm exasperated because we're the only ones doing this, right? So, you know, it's probably a group of believers and growing that group that's willing to sit down, talk across the aisle, hash out, you know, the differences and talk about what solutions look like rather than who gets the best jab in.
All right, Vernay, and then I want to get to a question from the audience. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, I think we're a training ground. I think those institutions need new blood, and the young people who are in our schools, the young people who are in our programs, as they leave us, as they go to law school, as they look into what their future careers are, we are training change makers. So those institutions need the students that we have MCFA Challenge, the students that are coming from the various teachers in the audience or classrooms, and young people need to be encouraged to say, take this passion that you have, go to law school, become a, you know, an elected official, work in government, and be a part of the change that you're looking for, because we need new blood and we need new people who are passionate and also think critically and have the ability to talk across to be in those positions to make those changes that the systems need.
All right, thank you. Nick Blumberg in the audience.
Thanks, Brandis. I am here with Anzaris, who has a question for the panel. What would you like to ask?
As an international student from the Dominican Republic, I can't vote. So I would like to know what actions can we take as part of a minority and a community who can do above the vote itself, but like we want to do something, we wanted to continue to grow in this democracy because we live, we work, and we study here, but we cannot do voting. So what can we do, and what actions are you taking for these type of communities?
75 seconds. This is the lightning round. Alexandra, we haven't heard from you in a little bit.
So one of the things that you can do is talk to other students, American students, about your experiences and get them to understand your side of things and how issues are affecting you and your life and the community that you represent. So even though you're not voting, you're a representative. You are an actual representative of a community and you have voice. Use your voice and you can do so very effectively in your community.
Okay, 30 seconds left. Marianne, top tips for being a good listener when you're meeting someone you don't agree with.
Top tips for me. Turn off that inner debater. Don't be planning what you're going to say. I'm not going to get my perspective in. Listen, absorb, and be able to acknowledge and understand. Look for the underlying values and be able to connect with that person.
Okay. My thanks to our panelists, to our audience. Thank you all for sharing your insights, your expertise. And that is our show for this Monday night. Thank you to our panelists and our audience again, and for, of course, those of you who are at home for joining us. Again, you can head to our website to check out the firsthand documentaries, in-depth reporting on the challenges and the opportunities facing democracy and much more. That is all at WTTW.com/firsthand. And speaking of civic engagement, the WTTW News Online Voter Guide for next month's primary election is up and running. Learn about the candidates, the offices, where, when, and how you can vote, and much more. You can find it at WTTW.com/news. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm and sponsor of programming that offers continuing education to fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.